Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 261. Why did I say it like that? 261. This week's guest is a wonderful one. I was really excited about this. It's, again, I keep having these recently, but it's someone I've been trying to line a podcast up with for ages, because we've kind of met each other up and down the way over the years, and we locked it down a month or two ago, even though I knew I wouldn't have room to release it for a few months. But I wanted to get it locked down because he's a fascinating dude and he's got a fascinating story. This week's guest is Jamie East. Yeah, we go into who Jamie is, where he started off. There's so much I didn't know about his story. It's that typical thing of podcasts as a host allow you to find stuff out about people that you probably wouldn't have found out just bumping into each other at events or hanging out or catching up or chatting. So yeah, it was lovely to do. I need to thank everyone for all the love over recent weeks. The Jade Adams episode went down a treat last week. A Winston Duke of us. I'm getting a lot more messages about the Winston Duke episode the week or two later, because everyone wanted to hold off and watch the film Us from Jordan Peele, which stars Winston Duke, before they had a listen. So that's nice that it's getting this extended life. The previous two before that, Johan Harry and PC Leon McLeod, are getting some of the most emotional responses I've had. So thank you for that. I'm a bit sniffly, I do apologise. That's not what you want to hear on a podcast. It is a new month, so hopefully you've been paid. And a good thing to do if you've been paid is to head either to patreon.com/scroobiouspip and spend a dollar on the Patreon page, supporting there. Or even better, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and have a look over all of our wonderful merch. We've got all sorts of clothing. We've got my live Edinburgh Fringe DVD. We've got CDs, vinyl, all sorts of stuff, digital downloads. So head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. We've got mugs, all sorts of stuff. Mugs, who would have thought? So as you've been paid, if you're a fan of the podcast, they're the ways that you can support it. I'll leave it at that. I won't go into crazy. I won't ramble on for ages. Don't worry. I'll just get on with the podcast, I think. We speak a little bit towards the end about Game of Thrones. If you're tuning in because you're a fan of Jamie on the Game of Thrones roundup show, then you might enjoy the episodes with Lena Headey and with John Bradley, both stars of Game of Thrones, and we have a good chat about the series in those episodes. So just search them in iTunes or Acast or Spotify or wherever. Easy enough to find. But for now, this is episode 261 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Oh, damn, I almost forgot to mention. Oh, I'm so sniffly. That's not what I forgot to mention. I mentioned that. The second issue of Pod Bible has come out. I'm coughing because I'm so excited. The second issue of Pod Bible magazine has come out. Pod Bible is a magazine for people who are fans of podcasts. And if you're listening to this, it's literally a magazine for you. It's free. We give a load out in London. We do shop drops. We're doing a lot of live podcasts we're going to be giving them out at, but there's a digital version online. I mean, you can also mail order a version online, but there's a digital version too. So the digital version, as you hear this, will come out on Monday, but the physical version is out now. So just go on the Pod Bible socials. They're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This edition, the cover star is the legend Richard Herring. And there's chatting there with all sorts of great people. Amazing recommendations. A great interview with James O'Brien. And just tons of good people. So check that out. Anyway, this is episode 261 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Jamie East. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2.
Give us
1-2-1-2. Hello, 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 hello.
Fine. I'll do a bit lower, and you can boost it if you need it.
Perfect. I appreciate that.
This feels a bit like a poacher turned gamekeeper or whatever it is. No. I've never been interviewed.
That's
before.
What I'm excited about. It's good. Are we going?
Yeah, it's gone. Yeah.
That's perfect. Mm. So yeah, I like that. It's a nice one. I genuinely find, and this is, it's weird that we're recording it here at the kind of the talk space and all
that.
Yeah. Because this is where I recorded the Colin Murray one, and I always, me and Stu Whiffen, who does the Hardcore Listening podcast and Off the Beaten Track,
yeah,
always say that having broadcasters on just make for the easiest podcasts, because you guys are used to having to talk for ages, or do you know what I mean? There's none of them awkward. Oh, where do we go? It goes back and forth all the more naturally.
We understand the arc.
Yes, exactly. So I should introduce. I'm joined today by Jamie East. How are you, sir?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, very good. Actually, it's interesting times. It's all.
It is.
Yeah, I feel a lot more relaxed than I should do, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that kind of, they always say that people get more emotionally attached to seeing, say, or hearing of, say, an individual dying than reading of 10,000 people have died, because you can't get your head around it.
Yeah.
It feels like where we are in England at the moment.
Yeah.
The drama and trauma has got so big, we can no longer compute it. So it's just like, all right.
But the news
cool.
is like grief
this
porn,
is fun.
Now, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it it's really kind of like, is.
It's just you're absolutely numb to everything, I think.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, I'm doing a few shows on talk radio this week, and I'm just, I mean, Brexit just bores the shit out of me.
Yeah, everyone's got bored of it, but it's, and I got bored of it, I think, as early as anyone, but it is the most important thing, yet I don't care anymore, which is crazy. It's crazy to have such a huge historic event. If you look through history at big events, you can't imagine any of the people sitting there thinking, I just don't care anymore. You think it's the biggest thing in their world, but for most people, you are just like, oh, well, whatever. I mean, this could be a huge historic thing. It could be huge.
Well, we just don't know, do we?
Exactly.
In 20 years' time, it could. Well, that was kind of, that's a bit of a damp fart. And,
yeah.
You know, what were we worried about? But, I mean, chances are it's going to be
a millennium bug.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Richard Madeley stopped piling batteries in his garden.
Yeah,
you know, all over
exactly
again.
Exactly that. Exactly that. But yeah, it is that kind of. It's it's terrifying. But it's. I think the thing you said there is ideal is that we just don't know, and it's one of the reasons I don't talk about it much. Cause...
No, me neither. Well, I'm not political at all, really.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not as political as I probably should be.
Yeah, sure.
As a kind of father and kind of, you know, all the rest of it. I'm probably, that's probably white privilege, though, to be fair.
You know,
the privilege of a white, straight, middle-aged, relatively
well-off
man. It's quite easy not to be, because I generally can get by day-to-day without having to.
Yeah.
And luckily, I'm kind of like a spare prick at a wedding in talk radio, where it's kind of like I'm bookended by Brexit and gammon and anger.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm allowed just to twat about talking about film and overweight tigers, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, have the light relief and enjoy it. But it's a true one, because what you said there about us not knowing is, it's why, again, I won't talk about it online, because I feel that the vote shouldn't have happened. Because we didn't know what we were voting for. And everyone thinks that you're having a go at Brexiters there.
Or democracy.
And and you're not. I'm saying the Remainers didn't and still don't know what's going to happen. The Brexiters didn't and still don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think on both sides, we don't know now, and it's years on. So at the time, it felt ridiculous to me. It felt like it was something that just went wrong, a little social experiment that went wrong, and kind of letting the sheep vote on what's for dinner amongst
the
wolves. And then they went, oh, actually, they'll vote, and it's gone the way we didn't expect.
Well, Danny Dyer's been the only person to speak any sense about it in the past 3.5 years.
And beautifully
right? Eloquent, just beautiful sentence.
Yeah.
And absolutely right. And
yeah.
I can't really argue with anything he said there.
No, it was so perfect. And it's the pause of them starting to move
second,
on. And then
it was the second
twat.
Second twat that nailed it. Yeah.
It's mind-blowing. Well, anyway, as you touched upon film there, and we mainly bump into each other these days at
either
screenings.
Saying hello or goodbye before or after films. Yeah,
yeah. And it's kind of lovely, isn't it? I'm new to that world.
Same here. Well, I've only been doing, I guess I've been a kind of, I've been paid to critique films for, I think, about two or three years now.
Yeah.
And I still feel very new to it. When you walk in those screenings and you see like your commodes and your people that have been doing it for like the year dot, who are very eloquent in their prose and their withering takedowns, and then there's me who has to prize out 300 words through blood, sweat and tears just to try and articulate what I felt about fucking Space Chimps 3.
Yeah.
You know, I do feel like a bit of an imposter.
But it's a beautiful imposter to be, right? Because you now... I think one of the greatest tricks to play in life is to justify your leisure by making it work.
But that's what I've always done. And
I think it's absolutely key. I've done it with... I stay up for every UFC. I'm obsessed with mixed martial arts.
Yeah.
And then I started writing for MMA blogs and for the UFC website and stuff like that. I'm like, right, it's work now. It's not a luxury. It's not a vice. It's work. And it's the same with films.
That's what I've always done, though.
Yeah.
Whether it was kind of like, whether it's been in the band at first, whether it was Holy Moly, whether it was Game of Thrones, or whether it's like the film stuff or doing radio or doing TV. Always. And it winds people up.
I mean,
up.
I feel I didn't need to make my notes now, because that's all the stuff that we're going to work through gradually over this
hour.
I wrote this down, for God's sake. I could have just gone off what you said in the first 10 minutes.
There goes the broadcast. I'm setting up the menu for you.
Exactly. It's perfect.
But it...
At half past, we'll be talking about Holy Moly.
Do you not find it winds people up, though? Do you get... I find that people get quite cross at the fact that I've managed to turn what other people do in their spare time as the thing that you kind of swap it around.
I think it's genuinely, this is going to sound over the top now, but I think it's genuinely one of the biggest problems in society today is that I had a guy called Rutger Bregman on, and he's an amazing historian and kind of mathematician and stuff, and sociological kind of observer. And he wrote a book called A Utopia for Realists, and it talks about how we can turn the current world into this amazing world, into this unimaginable a universal basic income and all these other things, get rid of homelessness and poverty and all this. And it's all realistic. It's not airy-fairy. I'm a cynic.
It's not John Lennon.
I'm a cynic on all this shit. And I was reading it and I was like, all right, no, that is scientifically backed up with historical studies and all this. But one of the things that we discussed on there is that problem that we've built a society where a large swathe, and myself included, growing up, will not consider it a job unless you hate it.
Yeah.
And what a horrible society to build. Like, oh, you call that work. And the example I used, I remember the first time I saw Twitch, and Dan Lesak, who I did music with for years, he does a lot of Twitch streaming now. And the first time I saw it, I went, is that work, is it?
Yeah.
A playing computer call that games job, and people paying, And then I was like, that's amazing. That should be work. If people want to, it's worth everything.
But mate, I had that conversation with my eldest son, who's now 25.
Yeah.
You know, for he was, I guess,
I look at
early,
Dan very
early
much
gaming,
as my son.
Like, shouting. I remember we were having kind of blinding arguments. Me, him, and his mother, kind of like, you know, the typical kind of classic, what the fuck are you doing with your life kind of thing. You know, why aren't you out there? Get some fresh air. You know, you should be doing this, should be doing that. And he was into gaming.
Yeah.
And he just ignored us. And he's now... I mean, he's been working in gaming for the past 3 or 4 years. Didn't go to college, which is fine, and ended up is now working in esports, which was not even a thing 5 years ago. It's a career that has just been invented out of thin air.
And it's an interesting one, because did you have similar growing up with music at all? Because again, music was one that it's like you need to stop doing that and get a real job. And then it became a thing where people can make a lot of money and people can have careers even without necessarily
the
big chart success. So like it's music has become like any job.
Yeah,
you can have a good middling income.
See, I missed all of that bit.
Right,
back when I was doing it, it was kind of like 96 to 98. Yeah. Kind of that was our kind of sweet spot, a very brief kind of sweet spot, but it was still a time in the music industry, certainly in England, where you needed that framework. You know, the internet had only just kind of was there. You had a website, but there was very little on it, and they were all awful to look at. You couldn't watch any video. You certainly couldn't download any music, kind of helpfully.
Yeah.
So you still needed the publishing deal.
So
you still needed
teletext.
Yeah, exactly. And you still needed all of the financial support, and it was crucially, though, it was at a time when job seekers allowance had turned into New Deal.
Right.
So it was kind of
what
like
was that?
That was the doll.
Yeah,
so basically,
oh, right. Yeah.
You know, way back yonder in kind of like early 90s, you could just sign on pretty much to your heart's content and crack on with whatever you wanted to do, which was how the music industry in Great Britain was formed, pretty much, you know. That changed crucially at about 96 to 97, I think, whereby you had to prove you're actively looking for work, and it made life very difficult for artists, for anyone in the creative industry,
of course,
where the doll propped you up whilst you learnt your craft, or at least kind of attempted to get onto that infrastructure that you needed to. That was all cancelled, and that kind of changed things. Pretty much about 2 years too early for the paths to cross perfectly with the way the internet burgeoned. So you weren't able to kind of just slip seamlessly into kind of just doing it for yourself.
And yeah, of course.
I mean, even things like the technology just wasn't there. You had Cubase, but Cubase was a pain in the arse.
Because
you had to have the Atari. You had to have the Atari monitor that went with the Atari. You know, all of this kind of stuff. So there was no logic. There was no kind of, you know, even MIDI was a nightmare. All of that stuff was just horrible to kind of work with. So it was just at the time that I was doing music, I missed out on the opportunity to kind of really kind of capitalize on how easy it is now.
It feels like almost heartbreaking timing in many ways, because there's that side of it. But that was also, it was just after that indie started to have more of a, oh, we can make this big thing. And Beggars Banquet, who you guys were with, were one of the ones that ended up being at the forefront of that, of going, you don't have to be on a major label. You could get a publishing deal and be on an indie, or just be on an indie and things like that. And it was Beggars and Excel and all that kind of thing that kind of went, right, we're as legit. It's not kind of you're on an indie and it's you're waiting to get snapped up. Like, that was the thing for a long time. It felt like
it was always a stepping stone.
Indie labels were basically feeder clubs in football.
But that's what happened.
They'll train you up, and then they will hope to sell you on for a big profit, and you'll be happy because you're going on to big things. Whereas it was Beggars and XL kind of just after 2000 onwards, so kind of just after you'd kind of stopped all that kind of went, no, we're just going to hold on to our artists, and we're going to become the majors. And XL is the prime example.
They must have changed
Adele
what they did,
and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I remember being on there, and I think, did they lose the Charlatans? I think they might have lost the Charlatans whilst we were on. Whilst we were on them, or certainly
then it was the Beekeepers was your band, isn't it?
Just, and the Prodigy were, I think Firestarter came out the kind of year that we kind of signed to them, which was just kind of, I think one of Keith's kind of like B-sides, Liam's B-sides paid for our entire Beggars career, all of that. Corner Shop were on Ouija at the time. Course. There was some, you know, it was a really exciting time to be in the kind of Beggars group. We were proper.
Because to explain that a little bit as well, Beggars Banquet essentially was a group of indies kind of came together as a co-op, essentially.
A guy called Martin Mills.
On our own, we're not going to be able to go anywhere near these majors. But if we all pull together and share resources and share contacts and stuff like that, then we can all get in all the indie record shops. We're not each other's enemy. That was the thing. And it happens with any smaller groups. You always start thinking that that's your enemy. And then you realise, no, your enemy's the massive
enemy's
one over
way
there.
Up there.
You guys are friends. Yeah. This shouldn't be a rivalry. And that's what Beggars essentially
together. It was a really exciting time. And I think the problem is, I think when your band doesn't work, when your band doesn't take off, you spend a lot of time dissecting that. Because especially when it's something that you've pinned everything onto, which we certainly did as a band. And it takes you a long time to kind of either realise or just accept that perhaps we just weren't good enough. Do you know what I mean? Because your initial thing is just to blame everybody else, and that's what the band did initially, blamed each other. That's when we kind of split up and kind of ended up hating each other. We didn't speak to each other for like a decade.
Yeah.
You know, then you blame the management, then you blame the record company. And after a while, I think maybe just middle age as well, you just go, you know what, fuck it, maybe we just weren't good enough.
I genuinely think that one of the things that I'm lucky, or it was kind of a conscious choice, but one of the reasons I had the career in music I had was because early on I decided I'm going to just do it myself. I'd been in bands growing up. I was like, if I do it myself, then if things go wrong, it's on me. If things go well, I get the glory. There's no kind of shared thing. And
that's a brave thing to do though, isn't it?
Because so many bands I was in, you would get annoyed like, oh, the drummer can't get a lift off his mum today, and he needs a lift because he's got all his drums, so we're not practicing. It's like, and I'm there like, well, this is the world to me. But quite rightfully, some people might be, it's just a weekend thing for me. Yeah. I've got a family, or I've got a job,
enough.
Or I've got this thing. It's bizarre to imagine that you're all going to have the exact same vision and drive. Yeah. Whereas, if you go, again, everyone thinks, oh, grew up loving poetry. I got into spoken word because I looked at it and went, that's something I can do without anyone else.
Yeah.
I was into rap, and then a few of those KRS and people like that got me into poetry as well. Nice. But that was the one to go, that's what I can just do off my own back. Yeah. I don't have to rely on anyone else or say, well, if the beats had come through on time or this or that. It's like, no.
But it makes it easier to blame other people.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a handy and destructive thing because then all of you are blaming other people.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no one actually getting the blame there because you're all just passing it off. It's that person.
The problem is the second you start doing it for yourself, it's utterly fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
And a billion times harder.
Yeah. Completely. But again, that's kind of it's the birth of fire, I guess. Not to turn it on to me, but I realised a little while ago when this was years and years into my career, I'd always told the story of how I saved up my money in HMV and then I quit my job so I could afford to try doing music for a year. I'd recorded my album and I went and toured living in a van. It was only years and years later I realised that when I did that, I'd never performed in front of anyone ever.
Really?
Yeah, and it sounds brave, but I just hadn't thought of it. Like, I genuinely think it's just in my panic, because I've recorded the record, I've practiced at home, because I remember going and doing my first ever street performance, and my mate Chris, who does the Hardcore Listing podcast and tons of other stuff now, he was there going, well, go on then, and I started to bottle it. I was like,
Shit, I've never done this.
And then his kind of point was, you've kind of not given yourself an option.
Yeah.
I'd put so much into it. I didn't have a choice. Yeah. I didn't have a choice. I'd quit my career. I'd left my job. I'd done all of this. I was like...
And not once thought about...
You've got to go and succeed now. Otherwise...
Yeah.
Like, otherwise.
But they're the moments that keep you going. They're the worst and the best moments when your arsehole's going a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, when you're staring over the precipice and they're the moments that you remember.
Yeah, completely. And it's the reason... Like, everyone would always ask if you're nervous on stage and stuff like that. I love being on stage. And the reason for that was all my first gigs were outside and no one wanted to hear it. If I'm on stage, people are inside and they want to hear it. It's like, this is relaxed. It's like, in general, that whole first 2 or 3 months was all just street corners and whatever else where they really don't want anything to do with you. So
I like the 5 seconds once you've started.
Yeah.
It's the 5 seconds before that, honestly, it's just horrible.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? It's absolutely terrifying. Well, kind of after you stopped on the music, the big thing that kind of launched you as who you are, I guess, as a broadcaster and all these other things, as a journalist, I guess, was Holy Moly, right?
Yeah.
And how was that? I was explaining it today to my missus, who's a few years younger, and my description of it, and tell me off if this is wrong, my memory of Holy Moly was it felt, in my mind, it was kind of BuzzFeed before BuzzFeed existed.
Yeah.
It was that kind of celebrity news type site, but it had an opinion. It wasn't just, here's something that's happened. It would have a dig at people. It would... Go in, it'd have a laugh, it'd take the piss.
How was
that, and what inspired starting that up, and what was the path?
I mean, it's not very romantic. Basically, I was working at Sky on 15 grand a year with 2 kids and moved the family down to London on a mortgage that cost like 80% of my income.
Yeah.
And I was brassy, I was really skint, and saw... that the internet was happening. I was at Sky the day that people at Sky got their email address for the first time.
It was
mental to even think about it. Like the people
at
just
B Sky B.
Generally, people would be walking around passing each other pieces of paper before then. It was nuts.
Amazing.
So it was just
a huge turning point to be at such a big entertainment thing at the point that entertainment changed completely. Yeah.
So and then all of a sudden, all the computers got the internet and you went off and I was doing night shifts, doing graphics, doing all the weather maps and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there were like long old shifts during the Kosovo war.
Amazing.
Where there was not a lot to do.
Wow.
And found Pop Bitch. So, and it was the first kind of website I found. It was like, these are my people.
Yeah.
Because it was just a group of fuckers just dishing the dirt on celebrity.
Yeah.
And luckily through the few years through being in the band and kind of like having an old man that works in the industry and knowing a few people, had a few stories up my sleeve.
Brilliant.
So I was able to kind of like participate and get involved. And through that, almost kind of became a bit of a super fan of Pop Bitch, but got quite frustrated with what the owners of Pop Bitch weren't doing with what I saw was just like, this is just like, this is why aren't you kind of like getting rich off this? Because that, because I just couldn't understand it. It's like, why would you do? They've got a different agenda, and they still have, which is absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But for me, I was looking at it going, this is your fucking ticket. This is it. You only get one of these tickets in a career, and you're sitting on it and doing absolutely nothing with it.
Amazing.
And it was genuinely off the back of that that I tried to introduce the owners of Potbitch to a guy called James Baker, who was at the time head of Sky One, because everyone was trying to do a Potbitch kind of TV show.
Yeah.
So I got James interested, and he wanted to meet them. But Potbitch pulled out after we kind of had a few chats about it.
Right.
And I was really fucked off with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd bought the domain name Holy Moly a couple of years ago to do like a design graphics kind of thing.
Right.
And genuinely told James that Holy Moly was the new one that no one really knew about.
Right. And was kind of before.
And what sparked me off was that he just believed it. And he was like, great, who else knows about this? I was like, hardly anyone knows about this. And he was like, right, okay, fine. And I walked out thinking, fucking hell, this is quite funny. And
that's amazing. So that's such a blag.
It was just, mate, there's so much of Holy Moly that was just a blag.
Yeah.
So what I did, which was, you know, possibly not the most kind of heroic thing, was I poached about a dozen of the kind of hardcore pot bitches to come over onto this secret message board, which was Holy Moly, and they're still there to this day. And that was genuinely, it was started this new message board, started a newsletter with the remit of being, okay, well, what can we do that pot bitch aren't doing?
Yeah.
And we just kind of went in a bit harder.
Yeah.
And the problem Potbitch had was that they were visible now to lawyers, and they were visible to such and such. People knew who they were, people who knew who owned them. So they couldn't get away with as much. Whereas we were this entirely ring-fenced kind of community.
Yeah.
No one, and I could offer complete kind of anonymity to all of these people and all these stories, because no one knew who I was.
Yeah.
So we went in harder, we went in faster, we went in quicker, and it didn't take long for it really to kind of make a mark. I mean, different ethically, completely different times, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did the lines get blurred there ethically? Because it is, if something starts to blow up by pushing the boundaries, then the nature is to push the boundaries more. And as someone who had been in the music industry and entertainment or whatever, was there any kind of, are we crossing any lines here? Are we doing anything wrong? Or was it, because again, it is key to highlight, and this is key because of things like James Gunn's old tweets blowing up and stuff
like that.
It was a time when bitchiness and cattiness and whatever, it was all far more acceptable.
Well, it was acceptable,
for
I think.
For better or for worse.
Yeah, yeah. For better or for worse. I think it had to happen.
Yeah.
For us to be, I think, in the better space that we're in now.
Yeah.
But at the time, the floodgates had opened because the anonymity that the internet offered you, or offered everybody, was so delicious and so kind of tempting that it was almost impossible not to get carried away with it.
Yeah.
And so Holy Moly certainly did, but as did everybody.
Yeah.
And the ethics and the lines were blurred, and it took a long time, and it really didn't stop until Amy Winehouse died.
Right.
For people to go, what the fuck are we doing? Or certainly for me, to go, actually, there's blood on a lot of our hands here.
That's a great point, because that was, again, that was a key one where, and I remember at the time as well, you'd put Pete Doherty in that bracket where the media or blogs that were blowing up were feeding off these people falling apart and being a wreck and being a mess.
Holy Moly, we didn't glorify anything. We didn't kind of put them up on a pedestal. You know, certainly people like Pete Doherty and the like, we gave a hard time to, because they were, I think, you know, I still think, clearly an addict, clearly in the throes of an horrible addiction, but also a bit of a prick with it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And that comes from kind of personal stories that I know of people that work with him and all the rest of it that never got published. So we only ever really gave shit to people that we, in our minds, deserved that shit. And a lot of the stuff we did was with humour.
Yeah.
You know, Cunt's Corner was born out of just us twatting about. And became a mental kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a fascinating one, man, because it all feeds itself.
There's a lot of Holy Moly that I'm not proud of anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, it all feeds itself, because Pete Doherty is a prime example there, and I've heard some horrible stories about the lad. But equally, again, as you said, there's addiction. There's the media are to blame for making him, however, the example I always give was when people, there was a real trend of people getting furious about Justin Bieber or about Miley Cyrus, yeah, and about how these, and I'd look at them and go, number one, you're a 35-year-old man furious about a 17-year-old kid.
Yeah, yeah.
But number two, these 17-year-old kids have been in the public eye from day one. They're going to have flaws. They're going to be fucked up. Because Bieber in particular, from about the age of 15 or 16, he was huge. Therefore, anything he wants,
he was my first ever
have.
Celebrity interview, Justin Bieber.
Oh, really?
That I did as myself, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how was that?
It was
fine.
It was a red carpet. It's a kind of like massive kind of crossroads of hypocrisy, isn't it? Because on one hand, he's kind of got $300 million and Ferraris and as much blow and as much kind of fanny as he wants, you know. And on the other hand, he believes in God and wants to do right for his mama.
Yeah.
And that's just America all over. It's just fucking nuts. Yeah. It's no wonder he went mad.
It's a massive, and again, he's another one. He's, and we won't go into it in huge amount of details because it's completely irrelevant, but he's another one that he's this massive kind of liberal, everyone should be free, yet he's part of that particular church that has got a history in homophobia,
which is now stuff thankfully like that, which, under the spotlight,
which is good because Chris Pratt has been blown up for it. I think it's always a tough one because I think I was having this discussion last night. I can't say that Justin Bieber or Chris Pratt or whoever else is homophobic, but they attend a church that some
they're
members of
themselves with.
has done that, which that needs answering, but equally, it's a tough one. I could go to a gig or go to something and not know that there's backstories or that singer has this and that, and therefore that doesn't mean I support it. But I've become
not every band is Screwdriver.
It's quite a confusing one, but that's so different from the times of Holy Moly.
Yeah,
right?
I mean,
it was the complete opposite. It was like right. Fuck them all.
Everyone, it was. It really was. I mean, the kind of tagline that we had was, being a celebrity is a stupid job, and it's our job to point that out.
Right, yeah.
Because
this
was at a time when Heat magazine was just so big, huge, 3 a.m., bizarre column in all of the tabloids. And they very much glorified, because they fed off the machine. So your Katie Price's, your Peter Andre's, your Miley Cyrus's, your Paris Hilton's, your Lindsay Lohan's.
Because they were the build them up and drag them down, and you guys were always just the fuck them.
Well,
there was no build them up. It was always,
kind of,
look at how ridiculous this is.
Yeah, it's this fucking nuts. You know, Tom Cruise is a fucking celebrity, and he's a celebrity because he's a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
Peter Andre, less so.
Yeah,
so let's not put them on the same
fucking
pedestal. Yeah. And that was what we did, was just to point out to people. It was like, have a fucking word with yourself. You've queued up outside a nightclub for 6 hours to see this guy who gave himself potassium poisoning because he ate 50 bananas in one day. That's who you want your daughter to wear on their T-shirt.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bizarre one. So, I mean, before we move on from Holy Moly, is there anything that sticks with you that you kind of regret on there? Any...
As on in terms of editorially?
Editorially, yeah. And or anyone you feel that you went after too hard or you shouldn't have gone into, or I don't know.
There was, after I finished Holy Moly, there's a lot of redemption there. When I started doing TV, and inevitably you start meeting a lot of these people, there have been lots of occasions where I've gone, you know what, that was... Kerry Katona sticks in my mind quite a lot. So Kerry was almost this running theme throughout Holy Moly's career, was Kerry's kind of... ascent or descent, whichever way you want to look at it, into our consciousness. You know, she was starting off as this kind of, you know, the typical British dream of ex-topless model, done good. You know, Andy McCluskey discovered a atomic kitten, all the rest of it, married to Brian McFadden, had the kids, and then inevitably the coke came into it and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So we gave Kerry a right kicking quite often. And I think that's just a naivety or just a kind of, or was an eagerness just to kind of join the queue.
Yeah.
And having met Kerry and know Kerry personally after that, you know, and clearly she was ill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, there are things like that where I think we went in too hard. There are a couple of, I mean, there were really grim times looking back at it now, because I was pissed for most of it. And the whole Soho and London was a very different place than it was now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was...
Genuinely, the advent of camera phones changed so much, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah.
I genuinely think all that Soho and things like that, it was no man's land.
Yeah.
It was kind of, as long as you're out the reach of the paps, which often people weren't, but no. Still, as long as you were, then anything could go. Whereas
and
now
it
became,
yeah.
There's no out of reach.
There's a lot of regret. You know, I spent too long trying to flog it,
yeah,
rather than trying to build it. But then. That's because that was always my plan. Was kind of like, well, I always said I'd build the brand and flog it.
Yeah.
And I did that twice.
Yeah.
You know, bought That's it back bad. Once and then flogged it
right.
again. So,
yeah.
But by the time my exit to Holy Mo came, I was really glad to get out. I was knackered and I was a husk of a man.
Yeah. I mean, we've touched upon drugs and alcohol a lot there. It feels like a good point to get on to talking about sobriety and kind of what your path was and journey there. Because again, that... Being, particularly in that at that time, it's such a, again, it's the negative of making, of justifying things as, this is my job. At that point, to be in the entertainment industry, there was a lot of drink, a lot of drugs. Mm-hmm. Entertainment industry is what's providing for your family. So you need to be in those circles.
Yeah.
But at what point is the line crossed / snorted in that world? Because it's... You're needing to put yourself out there, particularly if you're needing to get gossip and stories or make connections even, simply to make connections. And you can justify so much, as said, by saying it's for work, it's to provide, it's for this. And then you kind of go, well, actually, it's fucking, it's messy.
It's a trick. I've never spoken about it before, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, drink's always been a big part of the family.
Yeah.
You know, we've always been, always, whether it's me... My old man or my mum, or we've always been the last one standing.
Yeah,
always.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of like it's a bit of East pride there, is that you know, it nothing affects our constitution.
Yeah.
You know, it's all of that. And yeah, you're right. There is also the element it's like, well, you've got to be in it to win it. You've got this kind of romantic kind of notion of whether you know, it's kind of Donnie Brasco-esque kind of like undercover kind of way of getting the gossip and getting the stories.
It's turning that family trait into your superpower in the industry. Well, if I can be the last one standing, can get all of the news. I can be the last one getting everything in.
I'll see who was the second one standing and right about there.
Yeah,
you know,
it's that kind of.
So for me, look, it was always the booze, really.
Yeah.
You know, the drugs were there, but never, it was always the booze.
Yeah.
Every bad decision I've ever made has always been kind of after booze.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so I spent so long pissed.
Yeah.
Just either pissed or hungover, which is not a great place to be when either you're trying to run a business or, more importantly, raise a family. You know, I have four kids all throughout this, and I can't imagine that was much fun for my wife or certainly for them. I don't think they really remember much about it, but I was just out a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I was never kind of like coming home, kind of like throwing up on the living room carpet and saying, let's move to Brighton. You know, it was none of that. Yeah, I was kind of a flamboyant drunk. I was just usually knackered. Do you know what I mean?
It becomes I think alcohol can really become, and I think it's why, obviously it's got addictive parts chemically, but I think one of the reasons it can become addictive is it's a free pass. It's to say, right, I can do what I want now.
Well,
I'm drunk.
It excuses twatishness.
Yeah, it's a massive excuse. And if you're going out and at the back of your mind, you kind of want to be a twat tonight, then you have a few drinks and it's acceptable.
Well,
it's a conscious choice beforehand.
You're being less of a twat, and B, you could be, there's always the, really sorry I was drunk, rather than I'm really sorry. And I think, so after years and years of doing it and kind of, you know, and it affected everything. It affected my work. Certainly affected my work after I stopped Holy Moly and started doing TV and radio. Yeah, that was when it really kind of
you're on other people's schedules a lot more.
Well, I can remember doing Big Brother. I can remember doing Big Brother drunk.
Yeah,
you know, which is not
that's not great.
Yeah, and then you know you're never in a great. The only downtime you have, you're recovering rather than enjoying it, and I just disliked the person I was really, and. I'd realise that I'm just not one of those people that can just have a bit
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I used to get angry when people pointed that out to me, especially if my wife pointed it out to me. It's like, why do you always have to be the last one? It's like, well, I do because it's my work, or it's because, you know, because that, because I'm an East. That's what we do. That's what the East do. We know how to, we're the fucking party goes. We don't, we make the party. We don't just turn up at the party. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, that bullshit kind of assumption. And I just didn't, I just realised that I was just a bit of a cunt.
Right.
Really. I mean, that was genuinely it.
Was there any kind of catalyst there was key moments? Or see, was this it just is it. The kind so, of the build-up of...
This is probably
this
why
is
I, this is probably why I've never really kind of talked about it, because there was never kind of... I've spoken to other people who are sober, who are quite big public about their sobriety and whatnot, and they've always had that kind of rock bottom, you know, where they've been kind of... I know someone that's told me they woke up in some Bulgarian fucking toilets trying to snort a kind of cubicle kind of perfume cube and stuff like that. And so I thankfully never had that.
Yeah.
And just decided one day just to stop. But I don't really, I don't know, it's quite weird because I don't really say that I'm sober or anything. I'm just not drinking at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. How long have you been?
It's about 18, not it's about 18 months.
Yeah.
About 18, well, over 18 months now. So, and it's changed me so much.
Yeah.
And without being kind of evangelical about it, or going, everybody needs to stop drinking. It just, it's just what works for you, and this has genuinely worked for me. I just don't know whether I've just done it too late.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating one. I genuinely think for productivity, it makes such a difference, because I never had a drink problem, but I now drink, I think last year I drank 6 times. And again, it's because I've not had that problem that I've not felt I need to make this big stop, but I just stopped because exactly that. As when I had a tour where... Just before the tour, I had tonsillitis. So normally I'd drink on stage. And I just got over this, I was like, right, I need to just drink water, be ultra healthy. And it was the best performances I've ever given, the most fun I had on tour. And I suddenly went, I used to drink because I was scared.
Yeah.
I'm not scared anymore. And that just genuinely, it made me kind of stop and go,
the metaphor,
right,
you know, you see that metaphor in films, you see it in such and such. It's Dumbo, isn't it? It's Dumbo flying without the magic feather.
You know,
that's generally what it is. It's and it's something, until you do something that scares you sober, you don't realise that actually the magic feather is a pint of Guinness.
Or it's a line.
Or it's half a bottle of fucking Jack Daniels, or whatever is your poison.
Yeah.
So... And for me, it was kind of doing telly, or it was kind of writing, or even going to a social occasion without drinking, and still being able to pull it off.
Yeah. How do you manage at social occasions without saying? Because again, I think a thing that a lot of people that I feel I've known who have had drinking problems, but in the entertainment industry, the thing that they have is, they decide they're going to try and cut down. And in this industry, or I mean, forget the industry. I'm from Essex. In Essex, if you're out with mates, you say, oh, I'm not going to have one tonight.
You fucking come on, you fucker.
Whereas if you're out with mates and go, I'm sober, I've had a problem. They go, all right, cool. Do you want a lemonade? Or, I mean, I think there's a massive difference. I think the tough part can be when you're just saying, I'm just leaving it for now, because people will nudge you. Whereas if you say, I've got a problem, so I can't drink, then they'll generally accept it a bit more. So has that been your approach to kind of go, look, I'm not drinking.
I mean, everyone else had more of a problem than I have, you know, with doing it, which has been quite the funny thing. It's actually, I've been quite relaxed about the whole thing, and I found it, luckily, relatively easy.
Yeah.
You know, there haven't been many occasions where I've kind of got the thirst and thought, you know, oh my God, that red wine looks amazing.
Are you stubborn? Because as soon as I cut down on drinking, I'd get a bit of a buzz out of being, no, I'm good.
Well, you do the pink mist.
I'm fine, thanks. Yeah. No, whatever. No, but I'm everybody fine. People else. Trying to tempt you, and me being all so stubborn and arrogant about the fact that I'm not even tempted, mate. This is easy.
But what it kept doing was reconfirming why I'm doing it. Because when I say to people I'm not drinking, people go, what?
Yeah.
You? And you go. And all of a sudden, you know, very quickly realised that people took me. I was that guy.
That's how they knew you.
You know, it's like if three people are telling you three different things, then don't listen to them. But if three people are saying exactly the same thing, then they're probably right.
Yeah, they're probably onto something.
And it's that kind of thing. So it makes me stubborn. It made me kind of like, well, I'll show you. I'll do it for 6 months, you know, and then a year. Then it became a year. And now it's just like, well, yeah, I'll just keep going. You know, then I had a glass of red wine with my dad at Christmas, and it was fine, you know, but stopped after one, really.
Yeah, that's perfect.
You know, but so it's a tricky one. It's such a tough one because I think the second you kind of say, I'm never going to drink again.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden I'm on that pedestal then. It's quite a weird one. So, and I'm not doing it for anyone else but myself, possibly my family as well.
That's exactly it on my relationship with alcohol now, because I kind of, like, still now I'll be driving somewhere and mates will go, oh, you can have one though. And I'll be like, why would I want one? What's again, I've had that same mentality of growing up in Essex. It's like, if I'm drinking, I'm getting drunk. Yeah, that's why I'm drinking. Yeah, why would I have one? I'd rather have a nice Coke.
There's no such thing as a small glass of wine, is there? No. You know, it's a bottle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
why would you stop while there's some left?
So that's it. The six times I've drunk this year, I've got wankers. But that's the only times I've drunk all year, cunning, is at my club night or when we do the drunk podcast. But because of those two things being public things, a lot of my fan base assume I'm this big party guy. And no, the six times I've drunk, you've all heard about. That's all. It's not that it's all the time. It's just they're the only ones.
But we're getting on a bit as well. It's quite difficult to get pissed. You know? It's not much fun anymore.
It's knackering. I remember I think it's an Essex thing. In my teens, I would, on the way to the metal club I'd go to, I'd drink a bottle of a concoction I'd made up myself out of my parents' booze.
Fucking hell.
Because I was poor. So, like, I need to get drunk. I'd get to the club. I'd do a shot of whiskey because I knew it'd make me go and throw up. So I'd get to the club, do a shot of whiskey, go and throw up, and then I could drink all night, not feel ill, not feel rough,
if you wrote that down, it would just look like the words of a madman.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? It sounds absolutely manic. But again, it's only realising years on, I was like, that was my system for going to clubs. It's like, I had to throw up early, otherwise I'm not gonna have to enjoy the night. It'll be a bit heavy on me and I'll feel like I'm gonna be sick. It's like, no,
I can never see, get I can out never, of the way early. I hate it. All my mates that used to do that. Tactical vom, they call it, don't they?
Tactical vom.
I could never do it.
I was all over it. Well, let's move on to your TV career. How did it?
That won't take long.
Or how did it come about? Because the first thing that I remember seeing you on was Big Brother's. Was it a bit on the side? And that's an interesting theme I want to talk about as we go on, because it was kind of the first show talking about a show that's just been on.
Yeah.
It was kind of a new thing at that point.
The original spin-off.
Everyone was enjoying this. Let's now break it down, like what we've just seen, and I think Big Brother gets a hard rap and gets misremembered.
Snobbery.
Yeah, and I think it did it to itself as well.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's this innocent thing, but as a social experiment, I think it's one of the most fascinating things that's ever been made for TV. I remember I was asked to go on the celebrity one at some point, or I wasn't asked, I was inquired if I'd be interested.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I was like, if it wasn't on TV, I would. Because I felt for my kind of career, it's a negative impact.
Yeah.
And you saw it with Preston is a great example of how he was a credible indie kid. He's now forever that Big Brother guy. And it's this weird. It's got positives and negatives. It's done great things for his career. It's done hugely damaging things for his psyche and, you know, everything else. So, but my thought was always, I would love to go in it because I watch it. And I see him arguing over stupid shit, and I can think instantly of one sentence I could say just that would solve all of it.
Knock it all down,
And I look at that and go, that's so stupid, I could solve that, it'd be amazing to be in there. But equally, years ago, I was in a long-term relationship, and my girlfriend would stay over a lot. And the way she got out of the shower used to infuriate me, because the floor would get more wet than when I get out of the shower.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of thing, it's like, they're in close... Yeah. Quarters.
What do you do when it's Jackie Stallone doing that? Yeah, you're in a wild water pain.
Sitting there watching TV, you can sit there rationally. As soon as you're living with someone for a couple of days, those tiny little things, someone's eaten my cheese, it turns into this big squaring up to people, and you're sitting there going, these people are fucking idiots. It's like, no, they're not. It's a social experiment. That's the point of it. It's become just a TV show, but it's a known listed social experiment that was written about for years, so it's a valid thing. It makes people act weird, but
I was a fan of Big Brother, and kind of I guess unless it through ups I went ups and downs with it when it first came out. Everyone, you know, I was along with everybody, then it died down for a bit. And the way I came involved with Bit on the Side was because I sold the Holy Moly to Endemol,
right?
So I'd bought the company back off the previous owner, who by some kind of company thing was Len Blavatnik and Perform Group and all that, brought that back off them, and then sold it to Endemol Group because they wanted to buy it. And off the back of that, and this, you know, kind of, I mean, it's de rigueur now. It's what everybody does when the companies have merged, like this place here has merged with News UK.
Yeah.
You find that the radio stations are appearing in the newspapers. So it's an idea was to use me and use Holy Moly and vice versa with Big Brother, who they'd just done the deal with Desmond for it to move on to Channel 5.
Yep.
So as part of it, I just got sent along. They said to me, we're auditioning for Big Brother. They turned that series around in about 6 weeks.
Yeah,
so they did the deal with Desmond, and it had to be on air by, I think, August, whenever it was. And they had, no housemates. The house, you know, all of this, it was dead. It was in hibernation. So they had to really kind of ramp it up.
Yeah.
So they sent me along as the dude from Holy Moly to go and film a VT at one of the auditions for Holy Moly, just interviewing the people going in and going out. And it was great. It was good fun. And one of the guys, and I ended up doing a little skit where I tried to audition for Big Brother. Kind of, you know, it was a bit of a piss take. But the guy that was playing Big Brother was a guy called Ian Coyle. Who was at the time, who then went on to be the exec producer of Bit on the Side. Kind of we struck a chord and we kind of got on, and he asked me if I'd go on and join Alice Levine and Emma Willis.
Yeah.
Just kind of because Emma was heavily pregnant.
Yep.
So they needed some kind of plan Bs in case Emma either had to go off and have a baby or, you know.
Yeah.
And plus she couldn't do weekends either. So they got me and Alice in to do that. And I think it wasn't Alice's first TV gig, but it was certainly very early on in both our careers. Yeah. So, and that was genuinely it.
Yeah.
So I got given the character of the kind of the cynical kind of journalist as opposed to kind of the all encompassing kind of this isn't this great, I was quite happy to kind of play really, and it was great fun. It felt like I was on it forever, but I did about 5 series in about 3 years,
right?
And it was great fun. I loved it, and
it must be fun to be tasked with the kind of go on there and poor school.
My role was, again, it was like the Holy Moly role, was to go on and go, well, if you're interviewing kind of, again, Kerry Katona, that's where I met Kerry, and kind of Jed Woods and all those kind of lot, and your Spencer and Heidi Pratts, who are kind of vilified and kind of, evangelicized or, you know, kind of adored and stuff. It was my job to go in there and ask them if they'd ever been missold PPI. So it was great fun. And also from a technical point of view, to go from nothing to doing 5 nights of live TV a week, you know, it's a great kind of way of getting your air miles up, and really enjoyed it. So it was the best thing to happen to me and also the worst thing, because once you've done a gig like that, it really turns your head.
Right.
So it spelled the end of Holy Moly, but also because it's so tempting, and so you get so wrapped up in that bubble of live TV and the money and all the rest of it, you think, I'm just going to do this forever now, and then you quite quickly realize that maybe, you know, the one thing they don't tell you is that that's sometimes as good as it gets. Enjoy this moment, because, you know, you probably won't get another one of these for about 5 years.
It's a fascinating one, because it gives you that taste.
It's addictive.
And it's why that, I mean, the presenting area of the industry, the acting side, as I'm seeing, is you get that early bit of addiction, and then you find out, oh, there could be a year or 2 years
first one's always free.
Yeah. And it's amazing, though. But if it's giving you that right buzz, then it's what keeps you in it for the long haul, and it's what gives you that career. Because it'd be, if you've not had that taste, if you go into it and you don't get a gig for 2 years, you're going to go, fuck this.
Yeah, stuff that.
I'll see you later. But it's that thing that makes you...
Yeah.
So I think it's positive and negative. It's the positive that makes you go, do you want this? Because if you want this, then here's what it's going to be. But, you know,
I've always enjoyed... I mean,
it's not on a platter.
I've been lucky enough to kind of have about 4 careers. And so I've always enjoyed learning the mechanics of those individual careers. So learning how to do TV, learning how to be a web publisher, or learning how to run your own business or look after staff or not look after staff, you know. And then in where we are now, like learning how to do radio and even like here we are again, podcasting, the whole new generation of podcasting. Yeah. So to have the ability of kind of turning your hand and kind of learning, even like how to use the gear and how to talk to people
keeps it interesting. Keeps you as a saying that it's important to always be a white belt at something.
Yeah.
So there's always something that you're learning. And then,
I'm a jack of a lot of trades.
It keeps your ego in check. It keeps everything in check because there's something that you do and you go, I'm not that good at that yet.
Yeah.
If there's anything else that you're smashing, then it's easy to just go, ah, this is it.
But also,
important to keep those things that you're still having to work on. You're still having to get better at.
But I think, you know, I think that's something that hits you in kind of middle age, I think, a little bit, is the acceptance that perhaps you're not going to be that fucking brilliant person at any of those things.
Yes, 100%.
And you know what? It's all right. You know, I'm half decent on telly. I'm half decent on the radio. I can turn my hand to kind of pretty much anything to earn a few quid.
Yeah.
But am I going to be Dermot O'Leary? No. Am I going to be Eddie Mair? No.
One of the things that annoys me. And again, I've kind of, at the end, I've got a note, just because I know that we're both film and TV fans, and I just want to talk about some TV and film.
Absolutely.
It's not career stuff, but it's one of the things that annoys me the most in TV is that everything is... Is it the best TV show ever? It's like, no, it's not, but it doesn't have to be. Not everything has to be the best TV show or film ever. There's loads of... It can be really, really good.
Yeah.
Like any time I rave about something, someone will say, oh, it wasn't as good as The Wire, or it wasn't as good as Series 1.
It's
like when Deadpool 2 came out, I was saying, this is great. They're like, is it as good as Deadpool 1? And I was like, it's different from the first one, but I've seen the first one. So I'd rather watch a new one than watch the first one again.
But that's because...
So let's just accept that.
And the reason for it is, I think, is because whilst the way that we're being served films and served TV has changed, our consummation of those and the way that we consume those hasn't. So the problem, and it's like, and for instance, like, you know, I'm a film critic. You watch a load of films as well. You interview, you do all the stuff. So you'll know what these past kind of 2 or 3 months are like for films.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, every film you're watching is 4 or 5 stars and it becomes boring. You're watching so many good films, it's a bit fucking boring. You know, to go from watching Beautiful Boy to Green Book to If Beale Street Could Talk to The Favourite, all in a week, you become snowblind to it all. And that's one of the problems that we've got now. And it's something that I've had to learn to do, is to try and, especially in TV, is to pace my viewing and work. And you have to schedule your viewing. Because if you're watching True Detective at the same time you're watching Dazz Boot, at the same time you're watching Game of Thrones, at the same time as rewatching Breaking Bad, then... You're not giving any of those things, including yourself, the best shot at enjoying them to the fullest.
Completely.
So you've got to be ready. And what that means is there's got to be some average stuff in between that.
Yeah. There's got to be palate cleansers.
Yeah.
Or even it can just be a change of genre, which I think people don't get enough. Like, I get some stick sometimes because I watch all the superhero films and I thoroughly enjoy them.
Yeah,
and
likewise,
I know people go against them a little bit now, but... They're perfect as palate cleansers. If you're watching some heavy, dramatic, amazing
stuff, layered,
like,
you see.
This is perfect. It gives me everything I want. There's I can watch it and genuinely say, I genuinely think this is a great film. I'm not just watching a shit film to fill the gap, but it's not comparable to The Favourite or to these things. So,
film in particular. So, I'm the film columnist for The Sun.
Yeah.
So, I will always watch a film differently than, say, Robbie Collin for The Telegraph or Mark Kermode, because I've got a different audience, and that's not a class thing, that's not a snobbery thing, but there are different ways of watching films.
Yeah.
You know, I do the Talk of Film podcast with Hannah Flynn, who watches films on a totally different level than I do. She's she's a woman of colour, she's a woman, and she will watch for things that I, as a privileged white middle-class middle-aged bloke,
just won't even
occur to me. So I'm a basic bitch when it comes to films. It's kind of like, did I like it? Was it fun? Did it scare me? Did it make me laugh? Were the performances good? Did it look good? All of those things. And so you can watch Age of Ultron on a 10-year-old level, which is like, this is fucking great.
Or you
can watch it on a comic book level, which is like, well, actually, the canon there from Marvel number 60 said that Ultron would not have, you know, you can go on at that level, or you can go on the whatever commentary the director is trying to put onto it, or the producer or the writer trying to put onto it, which is reflection of our own society. So there's all these multi layers that you can watch a film on.
Yeah.
And any one of those is good for me. I don't give a shit how you watch a film.
I have to make a big point on my end of year film list. I do, and I do it as a podcast as well, that these are the films I've enjoyed the most this year. I'm not telling anyone else what
it could have been, what mood it caught you in.
Well, that was it. There was a year that one of the X-Men film was in there, and I think it was, what was the
Apocalypse?
No, there was another film I think that didn't make the list that got everyone angry. Is it In the Flesh? Oh, was that the Scarlett Johansson one? Under the Skin. That's it.
That didn't make the list.
I enjoyed it, but didn't make the list. And people were furious because this X-Men one had. But I said, honestly, my favourite moment of the whole year was watching in IMAX that scene where Quicksilver puts everyone in slow motion.
Right, yeah,
and
yeah.
The song was beautiful, and there was humour, there was genuine beauty in the movement of the shot.
Logan. Was that Logan?
No, it wasn't in Logan. It was in...
I know the one you mean.
It was
in the
X-Men one that was out the same year as Logan, or the year before. Yeah. And it was Age of Future Past, I think, because it was the first one that crossed over.
James McAvoy. Yeah.
And there was just... that scene, I was like, that was the most fun I had in the cinema.
But if it touches you, Yeah. You know, and who's to say, you know, I've got friends whose favourite films are, you know, I think are absolutely shit.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Enjoy what you enjoy. And that's what you realise as you get a bit older, I think. It's like, who gives a fuck?
Yeah, just, completely.
If you hate it, fucking hate it. I don't care. If you like it, just fucking revel in it. Wear it on a T-shirt. Mm-hmm. Could not give a shit.
Numerous mates of mine know that I am really reluctant to recommend films personally.
Yeah. Well, I always say, what films do you like? Personal.
Yeah, exactly that. It's like, I will tell you, I loved this film. I'm not recommending it to you. I'm telling you I loved it. Because I don't want the pressure of you going, that was shit. The big example was one year, my film of the year was, I'm forgetting the name of everything, Killer Joe.
Right, okay.
Absolutely adored it. Yeah. And two mates of mine put it on and they thought it was the worst film they've ever seen in their life. And I was like, cool. I never told you to watch it.
People
I just posted
very
that it's my film of the year.
Same with the film column. Every film column, I get people getting very angry, right? Furious with me for recommending films or not liking films. You know, I hated Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, people get very cross about that. But
that was one for me that I went in expecting to hate and I really enjoyed, because I didn't enjoy The Greatest Showman, which everyone told me was amazing.
I was the opposite. But I loved that.
Yeah.
So but I never, and it really makes me laugh and it really made me think, actually, fuck it, I don't care, because that was just brilliant. I gave Moonlight 5 stars in the sun.
Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah.
So, which is predominantly, you know, and I remember getting a DM on Twitter from some really fucking angry bloke.
Yeah.
I got a fucking babysitter, took my fucking wife to this fucking film that you gave fucking 5 stars to, and I sat there and watched a black guy wank another black guy off. Fuck you, you cunt! Yeah. That was the tweet. And I was like, yes!
Yes.
I'm like, brilliant.
And imagine the one that's not DMing you.
Exactly.
Imagine the one that did exactly the same.
And I was just
wow, man. I never knew I would enjoy watching a black man wanking.
And I was just like, well, you know, at least you got a reaction from it.
Yeah, at least you got out of the house, mate. Well, before we wrap things up, I want to talk quickly as well about Thronecast, because you can say that it's kind of another idea off the back of a spin-off show that the same as your Big Brother bit on the side and stuff like that. But Thronecast felt like the first that did it with drama, and that was hugely exciting. I used to do a film club at the Prince Charles Cinema. And I'd select the films, but afterwards we'd do a Q&A, even though we were nothing to do with any of the films. But the point was, in the dawn of the term spoiler alert, you watch something exciting,
and
you want to discuss it, or at least you want to hear it discussed, and you can't. Because if you go online, particularly with Game of Thrones, there will be fury.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter where you tweet,
happens,
no matter if you've got two followers, someone will see it, and they'll be furious. And it's why I felt things like Thronecast were such a great, a great thing, because even if you're not personally talking about it, you're getting those bits that you were thinking about, talked about and heard, and you can go, I feel sated now. I feel I've got that closure on that episode and can enjoy it. So how is that to be part of?
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I can't take any credit for Thronecast. It started off as a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
It was off the back of, I think, Ian Lee did one for Lost for Sky
when Lost was there.
And the same principle was used.
Because Lost, again, is a perfect one that you need to discuss all of it.
Yeah. And so Thronecast was a podcast with Jeff Lloyd did it for a few years. I think Grace Dent did a few bits on it. And then they decided to make a kind of proper show. They brought me in, brought Rachel Paris in, who's now, obviously, Rachel Paris has like gone flown. She's flying now. And I think what was clever about it was that it was a good marketing thing for Game of Thrones and for Sky was that Game of Thrones is so dense, so complicated. I mean, fuck, it is for me, and I do it for a living. Yeah. You know, even if you're an occasional viewer, or if you're an occasional kind of drama fan, it can be. I think Game of Thrones is quite scary for a lot of people because it's too daunting a task to undertake. So having something like Thronecast backing it up Yeah. It's such a great help. Even when it's something to tell you the difference between Tywin and Tyrion.
Yeah.
You know, some people need that. Again, yeah. It's those layers. You can watch you struggle to watch Game of Thrones without understanding where people are and why they're there.
All of it, yeah.
So Thronecast is brilliant for that. But also, like you say, it's like a safe house for spoilers. So yeah. You can talk about why the Hound is on Arya's list or, yeah. You know, the chances, you know, what are the rumours around Arryn's... Oh, what was it? Fucking R and something equals J. I can't
right,
remember.
Right, yeah, yeah. You know the one I mean. Yeah,
about John
yeah.
and yeah. about John and Daenerys yeah. and all, or John's kind of origins. So it's such a good show to be involved in.
I mean, it's genius and simple. I always nerd out over marketing stuff and business stuff, which is stupid considering I'm in entertainment. But X Factor is always the example I give because X Factor goes on. And the people who love it tweet about it, and the people who hate it tweet about it. It's masterful.
It's win-win.
But Thronecast and stuff like that was genius to me because it's like, well, you've got a show that's got millions and millions of viewers. If you can keep a load of them for an extra hour, you're advertising, mate, all these other things.
Yeah,
if you've got a rerun, the best bits of Soccer AM are on after Thronecast or on after Game of Thrones. Not that many Game of Thrones people are going to continue watching.
No, exactly.
That. You just go, here we go, let's have another hour. Where
and
we
it's
can
worked,
just keep
yeah,
them.
I mean, it's
we
worked
just keep
really,
them
really
a bit
well.
Longer. It's like, just, I know I shouldn't be looking at the market side, but just as a business side, it's like, that's genius. They're there. They're there and they're excited about it. Give them more.
Yeah.
And then you get marketing money and advertising money and all that kind of shit.
Consider it's a spin-off show for a digital-only, you know, for a subscription-only show. I think Thronecast easily keeps, I think, certainly two-thirds of the audience that watch Game of Thrones, which is mental.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we start gearing up. I'm off to Belfast, I think, the week after next.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you excited or scared at the impending end? Because the end of anything is always the... When something isn't ending, even if you have a weaker series, there's always that confidence it'll pick back up. Or a weak few episodes, there's confidence it'll pick back up. As you come into the end, a weak scene is going to throw people, is going to spin people and go, well, they've blown it all. They've ruined it. It's
The thing is...
Pressure's
on,
right?
I don't... It's going to sound a bit weird. I don't particularly care how it ends. And I don't mean that kind of glibly or kind of flippantly. I've just really enjoyed the ride.
Yeah.
And if we learn anything from Game of Thrones, I think it was Tyrion that said, if you think this has got a happy ending, you haven't been paying attention.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that doesn't mean necessarily for who's going to end up on the throne, if indeed anyone is.
Yeah.
I think genuinely it's going to be a slightly underwhelming, ambiguous ending, I think, because it's war, and war doesn't have a clean ending.
It's an outlook I can relate to hugely, and I confuse people, again, with mixed martial arts a lot, because I love UFC, I start for it all the time. People always tweet me going, who's your pick to win? And I'll always tweet back going, I don't care.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Yeah.
And I love it dearly, but I just want to watch it and enjoy it.
Yeah,
I don't care how it ends. I'd like it. Yeah. I want it to be a good fight. I don't care who the winner and the loser is.
Yeah.
Just want it to
be
amazing.
I can get as equally as turned on by thinking that the Night's King will just fucking smash everything to dust and give the bird to the 20 million people that watch it. But then equally, you know, someone like Arya having just killed Cersei for the throne would give me as much to throw. I don't mind. I'm just looking forward to finding out what it is. You know, Valar Morghulis, man. All men must die.
Completely. Well, I'll wrap things up there as we finish it. What's ahead? I mean, we've touched upon the fact that you've done tons. We've barely touched upon radio and podcasting. But what is the focus at the moment, and what's the future kind of?
I don't know, man. It's the same one. I mean, I've never had a plan, and I still haven't got one. I mean, it's just you know, that's as terrifying as it is exciting. I'm a hustler and I'm a jobber. You know, I'm kind of out there looking, and I haven't got a fucking clue. I'd like to do something with the story of Holy Moly.
Yep.
Very much. Yeah. That's something I'm kind of looking at the moment because I think it's quite pertinent.
Yeah.
You know, sites like Holy Moly were inadvertently responsible for phone hacking, which I think is quite an interesting angle.
Yeah, so, that's
which
madness.
Is one for another time. But I mean, you know, I don't know. Game of Thrones is finishing. I don't know what's happening anywhere else. You know, who the fuck knows?
Who knows
I'm 45 and I still haven't got. I'm still winging it.
Do you enjoy it though? Because I've got to that point where I think there's a benefit of not knowing what you're doing and it working for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Like I start each year, and particularly now I'm in this acting game where it's so inconsistent. It's like I start 2 years ago, I started the year with no gigs booked. I did two films and a TV show.
Yeah.
Last year, I started the year with no gigs booked. I got no gigs.
Yeah.
but it's kind of a buzz. It's kind of a buzz. It's like, yeah, it'll work out. Obviously, there's the podcast and so on, but yeah, it's that kind of exciting thing of,
yeah,
I mean, having that slight confidence. And it works with music as well. Every album I finish, I think, I've not got anything else to say. Yeah. I'm done. This is it. And then the next album comes, yeah, and it happens.
I think
so.
It depends on where your head's at. Some days you wake up and thrive on that uncertainty and you think, right, this is it. This is exciting because I just don't know what's coming. And then the next day you think, well, fuck this. I'm just going to learn how to be an electrician because, yeah, I read that they're on 100 grand a year.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those. So it varies.
It's easier for me to be excited with no kids or family.
Yeah, I mean, luckily, my kids. Two of my kids are grown up now.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
So I'm kind of out of the woods there. But, you know, I just, I'm a provider, you know, I've always been a provider, and anything that I've done has always been born out of that. And that's not meant to sound worthy or heroic.
No,
it's just,
sure,
it's just, that's just what it is from about being a dad.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the best thing. And that sounds really shit. Let's not end the podcast on
that.
No,
that's good.
But
but
I don't know. I just like working, you know, I genuinely like working, whether that's doing radio, whether it's doing TV, who the fuck knows, you know, God knows.
So where can people keep up to date with all you're doing on socials and all that kind of thing?
Twitter at Jamie East. I mean, the Talk Film podcast is done every week. I do a reality check, one about reality TV as well, which is always good fun. And then I'm always popping up here, there, everywhere. You know, I mean, if it's a really shitty year, the next time you'll see me, it will be on the end of year review show on Channel 5, which I seem to have done for the past 12 years, which is absolutely fine. But I hope there's more to it than that.
100%. I love those shows, and I love it when people I know pop up being paid to remember things, because that's always just a great moment. Because again, I legit think it's a great gig.
But what they've started doing now is they've started taking those and putting them and formulating them into different shows. So someone will tweet me and go, I saw you on the Greatest Ice Skaters Ever, and I'm like, fucking, I don't know anything about ice skaters. And they've just found one quoted it about Torvald and Dean from 2009 and shoved it in some Talking Heads show.
I love that shit because they're genuinely still so watchable. The reason I see loads of my mates on them is because I go,
it's because everyone sat there in their pants falling asleep.
Genuinely, me and my brother were watching a TV the other night and we saw an advert and we're like, it might have reached its peak when it was, and it was on a couple of nights ago, and I don't know if you were on it, but
probably.
it was a countdown of the top chocolate adverts of all time.
And I wasn't on that.
And I was like, man, they've pushed it. The top chocolate adverts. That's so specific.
Yeah.
But I watched a bit. It was all
absolutely
right.
Absolutely, it was all right. Got it there.
Thank you very much for your
cheers,
time.
Man.
Cheers,
man.
It's been a pleasure. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. I told you it was a fascinating one. Thank you for tuning in. I'm going to keep the outro brief. Like, one of the reasons is that a lot of people don't listen to the outro. So whilst I'm going to keep it brief, I'm also going to tell you I'm sneaking out a bonus podcast on Friday. And I don't think I'm even going to mention it on socials. I'm just going to sneak it out. So keep an eye out for that. But don't tell anyone. I wasn't even going to mention it here, but I said a lot of people don't listen to the outros. I will see you all next week and on Friday. But this has been episode 261 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Jamie East.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.